is after killing their daughter. Shafilia Ahmed's parents have been jailed for life. The 17-year-old was suffocated in a family home in Warrington before being dumped in Cumbria. The judge at Chester Crown Court told Iftikhar and Fasana Ahmed, "Your concern about being shamed in your community was greater than the love of your child." DCI Chris Ankers says the case was transformed when Shafilia's sister Alicia told police what she'd witnessed.
"Her evidence against the parents was compelling and disturbing. I know the giving of this evidence has had a significant impact on her life. Her courage has been driven by her determination to achieve justice for Shafilia."
In other news, there's been more medal success for Great Britain at the Olympics. Rowers Catherine Granger and Anna Watkins won gold in the double sculls. It ends 10 years of pain for Granger, who's picked up a silver in each of the past three games.
"Even better, if that's possible. It's just, it's genuinely dream come true stuff. The support we've had, the crowds today, the whole experience has been unreal. It's wonderful."
There was also bronze for Alan Campbell in the singles and Will Satch and George Nash in the men's pair. Karina Bryant has taken bronze in the judo. The men's cycling team pursuit squad are through to the final of their event. They'll race Australia for gold tonight. Jessica Ennis is at the top of the standings in the heptathlon. Tests are underway to establish the identity of a body found by police investigating the disappearance of oil executive Carol Waugh. It was discovered inside a car in a garage in South London. Police in West Belfast are investigating claims a mortar bomb's been left on a road. 100 homes and businesses have been evacuated. And a 6-foot boa constrictor's been found abandoned in a polystyrene box. Staff at an RSPCA animal centre in South Godstone in Surrey made the discovery outside their front gate. It's the third case in a week. That's the latest. I'm Matt Steele.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
I'm about to announce the biggest Soul Train Soul event Bristol has seen in years. Motions, August, Bank Holiday Sunday, live in concert featuring Carl McIntosh. Loose Ends.
Main Arena.
Mike Vitti from London's Jazz FM.
Alongside
Soul Trains, Conroy and Greg Alexander. Special guest, City Rockers. Alongside myself, Brother Nick and Ricky Duta.
Room 3. The Reggae Dream.
With Desi Rankin and DJ Flex. Caribbean Food on sale takes place on Bank Holiday Sunday, August 26th at Motions, Avon Street, Bristol. Tickets, £12.50 in advance.
More on the door.
Available from Bristol Ticket Shop, Genesis Records or Soul Train. .co.uk. Loose Ends. You will want to be a part of this one. It's going to make history.
Sport in Bristol is coming together.
Calvin Williams wearing number 033.
Bristol Storm Basketball.
He's lighted the flame.
Bristol Central Youth Football. Bristol Olympic FC. Bristol West Indies Cricket. Bristol Athletic Football Club.
We support players from every community.
There's always someone to help or advise.
Why not join or support your local community club?
Find us online in one place. Log on to sportbristol.co.uk to find out more. Sport in Bristol is coming together.
This announcement has been sponsored by
PW Logistics, your community courier.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news should be the Liberal Democrat councillor for Knowle, Chris Davis. Well, I've spoken to him twice about coming on today, but I haven't heard a word from him about not coming, so we're hoping he's going to come turn up a little bit late sometime in the next hour. Also, Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance is here too. In the second hour after six, blink and you'll have missed it, but plans were announced this week to merge Bristol's two enormous NHS foundations. We tried to find out why, but I'm afraid without the help of the present leadership of UHB Trust. And it's becoming increasingly clear that people in charge of our oil industries and finance don't care much about the environment. So long as they can suck out the oil and invest in cheap ways to get energy to sell to us, then the government will let them do it, no matter what the cost to us, the wildlife, or the planet generally. And Monday is Hiroshima Day, the one day a year we remember the tens of thousands of Japanese killed by the world's first atomic bomb used against a civilian population as opposed to a test. And I'm joined by also by local peace campaigner and author on the subject of depleted uranium, Joanne Baker, after six. And one very well-known critic of the official 9/11 story has just died this week. That's Gore Vidal. So let's have a listen to him talking about the post-9/11 world in America and his book Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, temperatures are up to 13 Celsius, quite warm-ish, cloudy with some occasional rain showers. This weekend, Saturday and Sunday, both warmish, 19 degrees Celsius. Some cloud with rain showers, a bit sunny at times, light winds with a few gusty bouts of wind, I guess that is. Next week, around 19 degrees Celsius, warmer by Wednesday at 22 degrees Celsius. Sporadic cloud and rain showers, bouts of sunshine, light winds mostly, but a bit gusty on Friday. Next weekend, that's the 11th and 12th of August, cool, around about 15 degrees Celsius maximum. Sporadic rain showers, some heavy, cloudy, often light winds, and Saturday a bit gusty on Sunday. But hopefully not too much in the way of rain, but a few heavy showers. Week after next, 16 Celsius, warming up to 21 Celsius by the Thursday after next. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And time to introduce this week's guest, because Chris Davies hasn't turned up yet. He's the councillor for Knowle, Chris Davies. But who is joining me is Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Hi, Robin, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Pleased to be here.
Now, can you tell us a bit about the Anti-Cuts Alliance? How long have you been going?
Well, the Anti-Cuts Alliance in Bristol was established almost as soon as the Tory government walked into Downing Street. Once we realised that there was going to be a coalition bent on cutting jobs and services in an unprecedented way, then many trade unionists, community organisers and members of the public got together and decided we had to get organised to fight them every inch of the way. So we've been going since 2010. We've organised demonstrations across the city and we're currently gearing up to combat the Liberal Democrat Council's decision to close care homes and to get rid of provision for some of the most vulnerable people in this city. And over the next couple of months, we will be really ensuring that wherever they go, we follow them, expose them, and put forward an alternative based on the very simple argument that in the 21st century, we need decent, publicly funded welfare facilities and not another opportunity for the private sector to jump in and take a great slice of the welfare pie, make profits, and then very probably somewhere down the road, leave local authorities to pick up the pieces when the damage has been done.
Now, isn't there a sense of a bit of unreality to the Anti-Cuts Alliance? Because you seem to be expecting the government to sort of dream up all this money to spend on these services out of nowhere.
Well, I think it's becoming more and more evident to people that there is an enormous amount of money in this country. The big companies are sitting on £750 billion, which they're not investing because they don't see opportunities to invest in traditional industries. That's one of the reasons, actually, that those companies are demanding that the government sell off state-owned facilities to give them the opportunity to get their noses in the trough in the health service, in education, in care, and so on. Also, if you just look at the amount of money that goes uncollected every year in tax, then if the government was serious about collecting that money, there would be no deficit. These companies, these tax exiles, never come to Britain, except this week. You'll see them next to David Cameron in the Olympic arenas enjoying the sport. But for the rest of the year, they're in Guernsey or they're in some other tax haven. And of course, if there's something that is unrealistic, it's expecting a Tory government to go chasing those people. But what we have to do is expose the fact that they are all in it together, blaming ordinary people for a crisis we didn't cause, and saying that this economic catastrophe is now likely to last until 2020. And they might give us a couple of weeks with the Olympics. They give us circuses, But this is a neoliberal Olympics. This is an Olympics that has priced ordinary people out of the show. This is an Olympics which the private sector has spectacularly demonstrated it cannot deliver in terms of the G4S debacle and so on. And when the athletes have gone home with their gold medals, when all these the seats have been folded up and the Olympic Park is empty, ordinary people will still be facing the same issues of rising unemployment, lack of opportunity for young people, pensioners fearing for their futures, care homes being closed down, and we have three parties in this country which you can't put a match paper between when it comes to their all saying the same thing, which is, yes, it's sad, but you, the people, have to have more cuts. And the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance say, no, we don't accept that argument. We didn't cause the crisis. We shouldn't pay for it.
Well, you've said a couple of times the Tory government. Actually, it's not a Tory government, is it? It's a coalition government between the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives.
Well, that's very true, Tony. The Liberal Democrats play the role of giving solace to the Tories, of giving the Tories the opportunity to carry on with these cuts. I don't think there can be many people who voted Liberal Democrat in the last election who aren't now appalled at the U-turns they've made on many, many issues, from student tuition fees to sitting on their hands and letting Michael Gove vandalise secondary and primary state education. Similarly with the Health and Social Care Act, Clegg bleats that he's managed to take out some of the worst parts of that bill. But the truth is that the NHS is going to be privatised with the complicity of the Liberal Democrats. Education will be privatised. And this party, which claims to be liberal and democratic, is neither. They're the party that claims the mantle of Beveridge, that likes to say that they were there in the founding of the welfare state. In truth, their epitaph will be there, that they were there at the ending of the welfare state if they get their way. And it's our job as the Anti-Cuts movement to do all we can, not only in Bristol, but across the entire country, to ensure they don't get their way.
OK, what about you and your background? How have you come to this? What have you been doing, you know, as part of your professional career to sort of bring you to the situation where you're now part of this alliance?
Well, I'm a long-standing socialist and have been involved in workers' struggles in this city and nationally for nearly 40 years.
Well, can you take us back through maybe one or two of those struggles and illustrate maybe a bit about the heritage of the Anti-Cuts Alliance?
Sure. Well, in the 1980s, I was one of the founding members of the miners' support group in Bristol. I lived in Hartcliffe at that time. I was born and brought up in South Bristol. I spent a year of my life, every Friday as it happens, standing outside of the Co-op supermarket asking people for donations of food for the striking miners. I helped to organise trips over to the pits to give support and solidarity to the miners. And in that year, I learned a number of things, and I learned very graphically that we don't live in a fair country. We live in a country where those who have the money and have the wealth will do everything and anything they can to retain that wealth. And ordinary people who very often want little more than an opportunity to give a decent life to their families are the pawns in a game which these rich people play, the purpose of which is to ensure that they become more wealthy and the rest of us suffer. So the miners' strike was a big thing for me.
Yeah, but hang on a second, because we're looking now at this sort of crisis that's going on in the world. We've got a financial crisis. We've got this crisis going on in the Middle East with a great deal of tension over and carrier battle fleets surrounding Iran. But the other crisis we've got is a climate crisis. And don't you think, looking back now, that in a way, by closing down the pits, the government was looking ahead to the climate crisis and actually trying to, in a way, stop the massive emissions that come from these coal-fired power stations, which the miners, you talk to a lot of them now and they will tell you, well, actually, it was a very, very dangerous job and we're not entirely sure that the right way to generate energy is through coal.
Well, I think that's a different argument. I've spoken to many ex-miners who would acknowledge that they wouldn't have chosen to work in the pits if they'd had other options. But that wasn't the reason why the Tory government took on the miners. We wouldn't be where we are today if in the 1980s the Tories had not successfully carried through a plan to neuter the trade union movement, thereby preparing the way for the privatisations that we saw in the 1980s and the subsequent privatisations that we're witnessing today. I think the issue of energy is an issue that is obviously very dear to everyone's heart. And, you know, I'm not saying that it would be fantastic to open loads of pits and send loads of men down into the ground once again. But once you acknowledge that that is not the necessary way forward, you can still come back to the question of, well, who is in control of the energy policy in this country? The same unelected, unaccountable politicians who, as we see in the US and as we see across the world, would do anything they can to ensure that big oil and the other energy conglomerates maximise their profit with only a secondary thought to the health and welfare of individuals, of communities, and ultimately of the planet itself.
Okay, a little bit more up to date. Were you involved in any struggles in the 90s, for example?
Yeah, I was one of the principal organisers of the anti-poor tax movement in Bristol. Was very proud to be a founder member of an anti-poor tax movement which grew in this city to over 80 anti-poor tax unions. We made a promise to the people of Bristol when Margaret Thatcher said that the poor tax was her flagship legislation. We said, we will turn your flagship into the Titanic. We will sink your poor tax. That couldn't have been done by myself and a few other activists getting together, but that was done because tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Bristolians joining people up and down the country from Land's End to John O'Groats decided that this was not a fair tax. This was an attack on people's living standards. And to give you an example, Tony, I mean, I live in Bedminster, and in the Marksbury Road estate near where I live, there were people who, before the poor tax came in, were paying £400 in rates. And when the poor tax was introduced, saw their bill go up to £2,000 collectively in that household. And we formed the slogan, Can't Pay, Won't Pay. But I have to tell you that the majority of people who joined the anti-poor tax movement were not people who had necessarily a philosophical objection to paying taxes, but were people who could not afford to pay. And we recognise the just cause. And sometimes it's necessary to break the law when there are unjust laws. We acknowledge that in relation to the struggle of black workers in South Africa, for instance, in the past. We acknowledge that in relation to the struggles against repressive social legislation that existed in Britain in the 17th, 18th and 19th centuries. But we need also to acknowledge that there are unjust laws being perpetrated against ordinary people today, not least the laws that close down care centres, that close down elderly persons' homes, that give the private sector carte blanche to come into the welfare state and pinch from the welfare state, from the taxpayers' pockets, monies that have been invested over 50 years to provide decent services for people as they reach their autumn years. And this Liberal Democrat Council, to go back to the point you made before, is really a council that need now hang its head in shame for what it's trying to do with social services, with local care services and so on. They say they will save £4.5 million over 3 years. So they've now put a price on what it will mean to disrupt old people, to take away provision and so on. And John Rogers, who's their mayoral candidate, I notice, said yesterday, perhaps not noting the irony, that the Liberal Democrat administration in Bristol is running Bristol services in a way that's never been done before. He could have said running down Bristol services in a way that's never been done before, because with the decision to allow academies to be formed, free schools to be formed in the primary sector and so on, there won't be a role for a local authority very soon. And for some of the councillors on Bristol City Council and elsewhere, who frankly over the years have shown themselves to be little more than place seekers in some cases, it won't be something we mourn when they disappear.
I mean, but to be fair to John, that's not his decision. That's a decision which is handed down from Westminster. They're basically just having to manage what's been decided nationally.
Well, you say that, but you see, if this is a coalition, if they are equal partners within a coalition, why aren't we hearing the Liberal Democrats saying no to some of these madder Tory policies? Why are the Liberal Democrats so silent when Michael Gove announces last week on the eve of the opening of the Olympics that it's no longer going to be necessary for schools to hire teachers with qualifications. Anybody more or less can come in from the street, and as long as the academy head thinks they're a good asset to the school, they will be allowed to teach. Why is it that the Liberal Democrats are staying silent about the creeping privatisation of the NHS?
Well, that's a great question, Robin. We have an empty chair here where there should be a Liberal Democrat councillor, Chris Davis, sitting. I don't know why he's not turned up. I haven't had any explanation from him. He certainly promised me twice that he would be here. And it's a pity that we don't have Chris here to answer your question. Chris, of course, was the Lord Mayor of Bristol from 2009 to 2010. And he's a Liberal Democrat councillor up. I think he shares the spot with in Knoll with Gary Hopkins. So anyway, we'll see how they get on at the next election. I'd just like to also, one of the little things I've done over the last few months, I've been putting together my list of what I call city slackers. I don't know what you think of that, but this is the list of Bristol City councillors who don't return emails or don't reply to telephone calls. You know, if you put a call in, they don't, you know, you don't get any kind of response from them whatsoever. And one of the things that I wanted to put to this empty chair, which Chris Davis should be sitting in, is why that their candidate for the Police and Crime Commissioner, Pete Levy, is one of my city slackers. I mean, I find it quite worrying that somebody who is putting themselves forward as somebody who will support the public in questions of policing, basically take over from what is now the police authority, doesn't return emails and doesn't reply to phone calls.
Well, I think that's a very good question, and it could be equally applied to many councillors. I think one of the things that I've noticed in the time I've been politically active in this city is that, in the opinion of ordinary voters, the council has become less and less relevant. The council is, I think, in many ways despised by ordinary people, because even when you have councillors who have a hobby horse or a pet project they want to put forward, many of them lack the confidence to connect with ordinary people in this city. In local elections, and I've stood as a socialist candidate on a number of occasions, people have commented to me that when I go knocking on their doors to talk to them, it's really surprising because they don't see local councillors. And that may not be true of all councillors, but I think there is a crisis in terms of local authorities and what they're for now. And once we have an elected mayor, we will have a far less accountable form of local government, if that's believable, than even we have now, because that elected mayor will be able to rule with just 20% of the councillors voting for his or her proposals. That elected mayor will be able to appoint his or her consultants, and we can bet our lives that those will be consultants from the private sector, get-rich-quick whiz kids who come in with great ideas to regenerate the city.
But hang on, Robin.
A lot of money,
look,
and go away again.
Just a minute, because the thing is, what happens if Bristol votes for a mayor that isn't a sort of corporate type, that may be a sort of more of a grassroots, up-from-the-streets character, who is actually prepared to be a bit more radical? So that's a possibility too, isn't it?
I would love to see Bristol elect a grassroots mayor. I think that's very unlikely. I think people have asked me, well, why did Bristol, alone of all the big cities, vote in the referendum for a mayor? I think there are several reasons, one of which is because of the unpopularity of the present council, the fact that local people feel disconnected to it. Also, of course, in May of this year, the only opportunity Bristolians had to register a vote against everything that's going on in this country was by casting a vote in the mayoral election. And I think a lot of people took the view pragmatically, well, surely an elected mayor can't be worse than the bunch we have in College Green. Watch this space.
OK, and I think, you know, ought to be really fair to Chris Davis. We don't know if he's had an accident or what's happened. But anyway, it's a great pity not that he can't be here to answer for the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, as we have an empty chair and an empty microphone where the Lib Dem councillor for Knoll, Chris Davis, should be. Anyway, on to this week's news review, Robin. And we've got 1,400 on benefits due to drugs in Bristol. This is in the Post on Wednesday. More people in Bristol are claiming disability disability, if I can say it, benefits because they're addicted to illegal drugs than anywhere else in the country. Government figures show more than 1,400 people in Bristol are receiving incapacity benefit or its replacement, employment support allowance, because of their drug problems, more than in any other local authority area. Birmingham, Glasgow or Manchester. The government released the data to try to generate support for its controversial shake-up of benefit payments.
Well, I think that's a very complicated area in terms of not knowing what individual circumstances are, but one thing is very clear, and that is that what we have at the moment on the part of this coalition government is a major assault on the welfare state, and in particular we have firms like Atos coming in now and being told to deliver a situation where hundreds and thousands of people are taken off of state benefits. Now, in relation to the drugs question itself, I think it's complicated because very often Tory politicians, or many Tory politicians, simply have knee-jerk reactions and say, in effect, that these people make no contribution to society, why should we be helping them, and so on. I think a more enlightened view is obviously one that looks at why people are in the situation in the first place. And one of the things that disturbs me about the way society is going at the moment is the fact that we are seeing the erosion of this idea of community, this idea of a welfare state which looks after people.
But that's the nanny state, isn't it? And there's a lot of people who would say the nanny state is a bad idea.
There are the people who
say... People become too reliant on the state.
There are the people who say that we shouldn't support political correctness, and therefore, presumably, they support political incorrectness. Presumably, they would love to go around behaving in a racist or sexist or homophobic manner, and probably some of those people do that.
But don't you accept that sometimes people can become too reliant on the state and not enough reliant on their own, their own wherewithal within their own family or their own individual abilities?
I think if you take a situation where people have been without work and have no prospect of work and are faced with living on benefits of just £100 or even less per week, it's very, very easy to slide into a mental state where you feel hopeless, you don't feel part of society, you don't feel you've got a contribution to make. What we should be doing is providing jobs, providing opportunities, providing training. When I grew up in the 1970s, there were night schools that people could go for. It. You didn't have to pay an arm and a leg to go on a course. You could take apprenticeships in the knowledge that there might actually be a job at the end. Now we have young people, but not only young people, being treated disgracefully by get-rich-quick spivs like G4S, who take them to London, dump them under the bridge as security guards or for the royal pageants and so on, give them a sandwich at 6 o'clock in the morning, tell them not to eat it till 2 o'clock because that's their breakfast and their lunch. And it's no wonder that some people reject the idea of this society. I reject the values that this government put forward because they're not about creating community. This myth that we're all in it together, that we should create the happy community, is flying in the face of the fact that public libraries are closing, youth clubs are closing, all the things, all the bits of glue that hold a local community together are being eroded.
But
the
hang
post
on a
offices
minute.
Are going.
This story is about drugs and 1,400 people on benefits due to drugs. Why do you think that this is any relation to that? Surely, I mean, there are questions about why it is that Bristol seems to be attract drug addicts.
Well, I don't know if Bristol attracts drug addicts.
I don't know if you saw it a few years ago. There was a film on the BBC by Colin Smith, who's a St Paul's filmmaker. He was filming people and asking them why they'd come to Bristol. They'd come from outside, saying basically just because the hard drugs in Bristol were cheaper than anywhere else in the country.
Well, isn't that a condemnation of the world we live in then, where, you know, we've got a situation where people don't see beyond, you know, going to a place to buy cheaper drugs. I mean, I think you can't just take these cases, highlight them, and then put them outside of the context of all the other things we're talking about. We are in a fractured society now, which is going to become more and more fractured. The answer to getting people off of drugs is not to wag your finger at them and tell them they're nasty people. It's to provide proper rehabilitation, proper NHS funded rehabilitation. I know people personally who have habits, who are desperate to get off of drugs, who when they have been offered rehabilitation find that it comes with strings attached, i.e. you can get a rehabilitation place, but it's run by an evangelical Christian group who want to tell you that unless you find Jesus, you won't be able to live a good life. We need, at the core of everything we do in our society, to have a welfare state, not to simply tolerate, you know, drug abuse or any kind of pain or difficulties that people are facing, but to actually work with people to help them get over problems they have. You know, you can be in work, you can be thinking that your life is going swimmingly, you lose your job, one of your children loses his or her job, you split up from your wife, your husband, you lose your home because you can't afford to keep your mortgage, and suddenly your life collapses. All the things you thought were certain in your life can change. So I'm always very hesitant when I hear these people making knee-jerk comments about, you know, drug users or anything else, because I've talked to a lot of people, big issue sellers and so on, some of whom are the most inspirational people I've ever met, because they're trying to get their lives back together. But it shouldn't be down to charities to help people and reach out to give support to people.
But I mean, that's the fact of the matter is state. That the government isn't actually providing these services.
Precisely,
so that's why
Tony.
why these groups. I mean, what's the problem with the other groups such as Christian groups coming along?
No problem with charities or people who want to help. I have a problem with people who want to help and at the same time dump their own agenda on the people they're trying to help. If you're going to help, offer practical help. But the most practical help, the long-term help that people need, is help that is around provision of housing. You know, what we have in this country now is the growing return of something I thought we'd seen the end of in the 1970s, and that is private landlords exploiting people on benefits, really forcing people into awful conditions. Yet you have the government saying, well, we're going to chop the benefits of people who are claiming excessive housing benefits. Excuse me, if these MPs realise how it works, the people who get the housing benefits don't receive the housing benefits in their pockets. That goes to the landlords. If you want to actually curb the housing crisis in this country, or the so-called benefit crisis that the government go on about with housing, actually put a cap on what private landlords can charge. At the same time, there's no social housing being built. I grew up in the days when it used to be called council housing. I got a council flat when I was 18. You couldn't get a council flat in this city today if you're 18. You're not getting an apprenticeship if you're 18. You haven't got a future. You can't go to university with £9,000 debt. So is it any wonder that some people tragically fall into a situation of despair and don't see an alternative? As a socialist, I'm fighting for an alternative. I recognise it's not straightforward, but that's at the root of what Badeker is about. We're offering an alternative vision, but not a pie-in-the-sky dream world of what's going to happen in 10 years' time. A fight now to defend jobs and services in this city, to ensure that people live with the dignity that we deserve. After all, Tony, this is the 21st century. This isn't the 1930s. We've got... Victorian times. In one sense, very worryingly, of course, we're going back. We're hurtling back to the 1930s or Victorian times. But that's why the services that we have, the services that were created in the years after the war, by Beveridge, by the post-war Labour government, with the consensus of many of the politicians from across the board, Grimmond of the Liberals, the Gates School leadership in the Labour Party, Macmillan and others, there was an acknowledgement after the war, perhaps the forced acknowledgement, because they knew that people were very angry, but there was nevertheless an acknowledgement that the welfare state in this country was something that had to be at the root of creating a decent society. And why? Because the private sector had failed in the past. And all that's happening now is we're going back. We're giving the prize of our welfare state back to a private sector which will fail and which subsequently will have to be bailed out subsequently, as indeed we've seen with the banks.
Okay, now back to the 1,400 people in Bristol on benefits due to drugs and questions over that. Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you what you think about this quite shocking statistic that Bristol's more people on drugs than anywhere else in the country are on benefits.
Is drug addiction a disability, and are benefits helping or killing people in the long term?
It's due to people's inability to be able to control their lives that they are actually taking drugs in the first place. I feel that there is something missing in their lives in terms of aims, objectives, and what they really want out of life.
I think it's most effectively treated as a disability if you want to actually change situation. As to whether benefits are helping or killing people, probably monetary benefits help people just hold it together and give them an opportunity to start building their lives back, but it won't do much good without other kinds of benefits as well.
Well, it depends what they're spending that money on. I mean, if they're spending the money on that drugs, it's killing them.
Personally, I think it is a disability. I think if people end up with hard drugs habits, that it is an illness, and I think most people that have hard drugs habits don't want them. Maybe they're not helping, maybe they are. Focus should be on rehabilitation, not just on handout.
I think the drugs is killing people.
Well, in my opinion, I completely disagree with drugs, so probably no, I wouldn't. Personally, I wouldn't describe it as a disability, no.
Like, it could be, but I think it's more likely if you're giving people money that are addicted to drugs, like, what's the obvious answer is that they're going to be using it to buy more drugs.
How should we break the cycle of drug dependency?
What they really need is a rehabilitation programme to be able to get them from the drugs onto something which is more in keeping with the society in which we live in now. I definitely think it has to be one of education. It has to be a motive and an intention for the person who has got the unfortunate tendency towards taking drugs to try and come off those drugs, and that they need to be able to be shown the error of the ways in which they're approaching life in general.
Oh, I think if there were easy answers, we'd already know them. I think there needs to be a lot more research and a lot more help for people.
I think control would be the best way of dealing with it. I think decriminalisation, the drugs which cause the problems, in the sense that it shouldn't be considered a crime, these people should be given help because most of them don't want the dependencies. I think the knowledge is there, and I think it's given. Popular culture in certain aspects glorifies some drug use.
Does it mean that Bristol has the biggest drug problem in the UK? Who is responsible for it?
Bristol has always had a very, very good health and safety programme towards drug rehabilitation. There is a lot of people who have come from other cities within the UK who have used the facilities within Bristol to try and get themselves from the habit of drugs. It's a UK national-wide problem. I believe that it is the own person's responsibility to take care of their own health and safety and their own lifestyle.
I think a lot of people with drug problems will have gravitated to Bristol for one reason or another. It's not necessarily a problem that's coming from within the city.
Taking that stat, possibly it does mean that. And in terms of who's responsible for it, probably the government as a whole for not cracking down on the drug dealers.
I don't think it necessarily means that Bristol has the biggest drug problem in the UK. I think it's just got the biggest reported drug problem in the UK.
I see there are a lot of people that smoke marijuana or something like that, and I think it's because police doesn't do anything with this. In Polish, when policemen every time ask, look, what you do, here you can do whatever you like.
Not necessarily. It might not have, it just has the most people trying to claim benefits for it. In terms of who's responsible for it, well, themselves, really. You don't have to take drugs.
Well, there's a bit of everything there, Robin. I think, actually, I was quite surprised that people are much more sympathetic than the Evening Post seemed to be to people on drugs, saying that really it's a kind of disability and that they do need help. Of course, the obvious thing is if they're not getting the benefits, they're going to be going out stealing from people and committing crime to get the money to buy the drugs. That seems to be the sort of baseline way of understanding what's going on. So what do you think of those comments, particularly, you know, particularly the idea about unemployment often leads people often into the whole sort of black market trade in the first place? Maybe, you know, if more people had jobs, the less people would be taking drugs.
Well, I think that's very true. In the 1980s, when I was living in Hartcliffe, I had a lot of friends who were involved loosely in the drugs world in Norwest. And when I say loosely involved, these were young people that I was trying to get involved in fighting the Tory government, but they had become runners, really, for people who earned a lot more money from drugs than ever they would see. And they were earning that money to supplement very meagre unemployment benefits. Now, some of them used drugs, some of them didn't. Some of them, in fact, came over to the idea that drugs weren't the answer and got involved in politics, got involved in helping to look at the wider picture. But I do think that the issue about rehabilitation is fundamental to this as well, because if people are looking to get off of drugs but services are being cut, then it becomes much more difficult. And it is, you know, a very complex medical question in terms of, you know, the different emotional and psychological impact that drugs have on people, but the conditions that drive them to that also have to be looked at.
Now, just some of the Bristol politicians have made comments about this story. Bristol West Liberal Democrat MP Stephen Williams said there may well be a lot of people receiving benefits because of drug addiction, but curtailing their benefits isn't going to deal with that. Charlotte Leslie, who's a Conservative MP for Bristol North West, said it's obviously bad for everybody if we've got a large number of people languishing on benefits because of drug or alcohol problems. They are not getting the support. It doesn't help them if all they're getting from the state is something to feed the habit. They need to break the cycle. And Regina Birto from Knoll West Alcohol and Drug Service said Bristol's high numbers of claimants could mean the city has actually quite a good network of support and information for addicts.
Well, I think Charlotte Leslie's comments show that, on the one hand, she does recognise that it is necessary to look at the other questions of what you can do to offer an alternative to young or not so young people who are caught up in this desperate trap. But of course, her policies and her government's policies of cutting services, of cutting communities, jobs and so on, do absolutely nothing to take the debate forward. The rehabilitation service that people need is being massively cut back. And I think that we therefore have to look at the situation in terms of saying, well, we've got to reach out to young people, and not just young people, and give them hope, give them an alternative, give them a vision of a society in which they belong. And in the short term, the idea that you take the benefits away from them is frankly ludicrous, because not only are you going to leave those people utterly destitute and, as you say, more likely to offend in other ways in order to obtain money simply to live, never mind purchase drugs, but also you have to give people the opportunity to become reinvolved in society.
Okay, Robin, on to our next story, and this is on the Tax Justice Network. Maybe a possible solution to some of this being that we could collect tax from the super rich 1% who are keeping all their money offshore, as is, of course, David Cameron's family and his dad. Ian Cameron, back in the 1980s, was one of the pioneers of offshoring your money so you didn't have to pay tax. And the Tax Justice Network have just started something called the Tax Cast, which is, I think it's been going for a couple of months now, but I've only just come across it, which is a monthly podcast to bring you up to date with what's going on in the world of tax justice or injustice. So they're at taxresearch.org. taxhavens.com/taxcast. And here's a little extract from the latest one, the July August tax cast, with their presenter Naomi Fowler.
Now we're going to talk to Richard Murphy for his take on tax justice events this month. Right, Richard, let's start with Norway. They're going to make all Norwegian companies report how much tax they pay in each country where they operate. Good news.
Any multinational company based in Norway will have to disclose how much tax it does or does not pay in every country in which it operates. It paves the way to the disclosure of all the information about what their sales are in those countries, what their profits are in those countries, and so on, which truly gives us country by country reporting. And it sets the path for genuinely moving towards a new understanding of how companies organise their internal structures to not pay tax.
Okay, so we've got the EU currently considering adopting country by country reporting legislation. Won't unscrupulous companies just register outside Norway or register outside the EU? I mean, isn't Singapore and places like this going to be the direct beneficiaries of legislation like this?
The answer is that actually it is going to be very hard indeed for most companies to get round this legislation. If they are registered on a European stock exchange, or in the case of Norway, in a Norwegian stock exchange, then they are going to be subject to these rules. Now, there are a lot of companies who, for tax purposes, are incorporated in tax havens. For example, Glencore is incorporated in Jersey. And the European rules and the Norwegian rules are about companies that are registered on their stock exchanges as well as companies that are registered in their locations, so actually incorporated in those countries. So this is quite clever stuff. They've got the companies in two ways. And whilst the companies can try and move to a tax haven for incorporation purposes, there are no credible stock exchanges in tax havens, and as a result, they're not going to be located there. So there's going to be no place to hide.
OK, well, let's move on to HSBC, and you really couldn't make up some of this stuff. They say they're very sorry.
I'm sure they say they're very sorry. They're very sorry to have been found out. Everybody is when they're caught. Time and again, we in the Tax Justice Network have rejected the claims that large banks make and tax havens make that they are well regulated. The pieces of paper might be in place to say that regulation was happening, but the reality was that money laundering was taking place. This pinstripe mafia of bankers, lawyers and accountants who operate tax haven locations on behalf of these banks are facilitating international crime. We need to now change the regulations, we need to change the rules on banking, we need to change the rules on tax havens to stop this happening again. And all those things are possible.
Why are we not seeing any prosecutions? This is clearly massive fraud.
It is extraordinary that there are no prosecutions going on here, and the difficulty that we have time and again in the UK is that it is very difficult under UK law to say that a particular person has undertaken a fraud when a corporation has done it. In the USA, under the Sarbanes-Oxley laws with regard to internal controls, there is personal liability for the people who sign the accounts. Literally, put their signature to say the accounts are right on the balance sheet. And that's normally the chairman or the chief executive or the finance director. And if there's something wrong, there was a failure of internal control, then they're liable. Now, it's very obvious there was a failure of control at HSBC. They were not regulating money laundering. It's expected they'll pay a fine of at least $1 billion. These people have cost the company and the shareholders, who might be pensioners and others, in this company a great deal. And yet they can walk away in the UK. That's not reasonable. We have to make a change in the law to now hold these people to account for what they do wrong and make them personally liable, not just for the cost, but for the criminal penalty.
That was the Tax Justice Network's TaxCast, the latest one. That was Naomi Fowler reporting. Now, Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, I imagine that's kind of music to your ears there, because what they're essentially saying is that actually there's plenty of money out there, it's just that it's all been squirreled away in these tax havens. And what bothers me particularly is the comments there about, HSBC, the pinstripe mafia, and then basically dodging the blame because they're a corporation. Nobody, it seems, is responsible, including Lord Green, who's a cabinet minister, never been elected by anybody, but he was taken from being the chair of HSBC at the time that this money laundering was going on and placed into the House of Lords, and he's now a cabinet minister. And it seems that all they have to do, a bit like the Leveson inquiry, is to step up to the microphone and say sorry, and then everyone forgets about it.
Yeah, I mean, all the banks, to varying degrees, have got their hands dirty in ways that have, I'm sure, yet to be revealed in some cases. The money laundering with HSBC is perhaps one of the most shocking indictments of the way banks are run in the 21st century. But it doesn't come as a surprise to me. For the last 25 years, the entire thrust of neoliberal policy has been to release the banks from any social obligations, from any obligations to their customers, and to allow their investment wings to make hay like there was no tomorrow.
Now, so in Iceland, they've prosecuted these bankers. Several of them have gone to jail. Why haven't we in the City of London, which is supposed to be the sort of pinnacle of the global financial system? We are supposed to be the best.
The Tories would say, of course, and unfortunately many on the Labour front bench would echo them, that we can't take action against the City of London because it would damage confidence. We would see these bankers withdrawing their capital and withdrawing themselves from London, moving to Frankfurt, moving to Beijing or the Far East or wherever. My attitude would be good riddance to them. If these are the masters of the universe, what have they really done in the last 5 years except nearly wreck our country?
And what is the point of the confidence-giving money launderers and criminal gangs the confidence to walk into the city to launder their money for them?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is, I think, that they will always invent new ways of escaping their social responsibilities, of evading their tax and so on. Richard Murphy talks approvingly of the situation in Norway and talks about the individual responsibility that can be levelled against bankers in the US. But the entire capitalist system is based on the idea that private enterprise must be unfettered and must be allowed to bend or break laws, and only when they get found out do they make a song and dance about it. But in the case of the banks, they're not even prosecuting individuals. I mean, the worst that's happened is a couple of bankers have lost huge bonuses or have been forced to resign, but have still walked away with a Gordon payoff of an eye-watering amount that you and I and the people listening to this programme will probably never see in their lifetimes. And well, I think one of them's had his knighthood taken away. Well, big deal.
The other side of the coin, of course, is another story this week, which is that homelessness has risen 25% in England over the past 3 years. Local housing authorities must provide emergency housing for priority need groups, and the number of households declared in need of emergency accommodation in England rose by 25% over the past 3 years, new figures suggest. SS Entif said that some 50,290 families and individuals were classed as homeless in 2011-12, up from 40,000 in 2009-10. Now, that's emergency homeless. We're not talking about people who are just simply sofa surfing, this kind of thing. So that's the other side of the coin, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. David Cameron's solution to the homeless question, or at least his partial solution, is, of course, to say that young people shouldn't expect to have their own home or to have their own flat, but must be prepared to live with mum and dad perhaps until they're 30 or even 35. Perhaps he's got more rooms in his house than I have, but for most of us living in the real world, what we want for our children when they grow up is an opportunity to get on the first rung of the ladder, not necessarily in terms of property, but in terms of making a way for themselves in the world. And all these opportunities are now being taken away. And homelessness and the chronic lack of house building in this country is another severe indictment of the policy of this Tory government. They talk about not knowing why the recession is getting worse, but the cuts have had a catastrophic impact across the construction sector. You have no houses being built in this country. Now the Olympic buildings are all complete. More construction workers will be out of work. And there is something ludicrous about a situation where there is a desperate need for housing. There are hundreds of thousands of tons of building materials lying idle in depots. And there are hundreds of thousands of building workers with the skills to build homes. And this system can't put the three ingredients together and come up with a house building programme.
Now, I've got a theory about that. I was wandering around the fields of Gloucestershire last week, and this week actually, and going through some of the villages. There's a tremendous amount of work going on in some of these villages. House extensions, this kind of thing. So it seems pretty clear to me that there is some work out there, but it tends to be in, you know, sort of nice, cosy houses, having replacement roofs, this kind of thing. So there is some work for these construction workers.
Sure, but not on anything like the scale that would satisfy the needs of people in this country. After 1945, There was a plan to build over 1 million homes a year, and between 1945 and 1949, that plan was realised. This shabby little coalition government has given up on the concept of council housing. People who live in council houses, or social housing as they now call it, are demonised, are told that they've got no right to expect to stay in that house for their entire lives. And therefore, the housing crisis is one more indictment of this society. And well, yes, there is some work being done, but it's being done in places that are not the main areas that we need work doing in. We need inner city regeneration. We need council houses rebuilt and put on their feet.
Well, there's another side to this as well, Robin, and that is that a lot of old people now are getting very worried that in order to pay for care, that they're going to have to sell their homes. In fact, obviously, it's already starting. So it's not just people in social housing who are starting to see the threats for them being essentially made homeless and having to... It's okay, what they're saying is, you can keep your house until you die and then we're going to have it off you. But this is a whole sea change in this whole... Even the sort of Daily Mail reading middle classes are having to face the fact that the system, the government, is going to be taking their homes off of them.
Well, this comes back to the point we were making before, that there is a fundamental assault taking place on all the parts of the welfare state that made Britain a civilised society, especially after 1945. And if you take away people's homes at the end of their lives, and those people are then forced into private care, which will be hugely more expensive than local authority care, hugely more vulnerable in terms of the conditions that those elderly people will face, then you're not resolving the housing crisis. You're not actually looking after people. I mean, it's a scandal, isn't it? Here we are in 2012. We're being told people are going to work till 68, 69, 70. We're being told they have to pay more into their pensions to get less back. Because of the banking crisis, someone who is retiring this month or last month would have lost an additional 6% of their pension pot simply because unelected bankers, the so-called masters of the universe, these very intelligent men and women, or so we were told, have brought the country to the edge of the precipice and we have to pay. So, you know, housing across the board is a crisis in this country, and there are many tens of thousands of people in their own accommodation paying mortgages who are only surviving because the interest rates have been so low for the last couple of years. Were there to be an increase in interest rates, we would see home repossessions shooting
and
up
those
as well.
People, yeah, and those people are, you know, finding it going to find it difficult if those interest rates increase. Right, on to our final story this week, Robin, and the Bristol mayoral favourites are split over the care closures that you mentioned at the start of the hour. And men and women vying to be Bristol's first elected mayor have given a mixed response to plans to close the city's care homes, the Post told us on Wednesday. Liberal Democrat controlled city council last week voted to close eight of its care homes over the next 3 years. The authority will close all its elderly people's homes, only running those for rehabilitation and for people with dementia in the future. Now, candidate George Ferguson told the Post, "My instinct is that the current system is unsustainable. It's a huge problem of national proportions, but we shall clearly have to find more community and home-based solutions to care for the elderly. I would like Bristol to be leading the way on this front." Marvin Rees, a Labour candidate, said he would like to see fewer care homes closed. He said, "We face a major challenge because the coalition government is backing Bristol and other councils into a corner, cutting their social care budgets to the bone. And against the background of an ageing population, it leaves elderly and vulnerable people at risk, and the city council facing the prospect of paying private providers more than the cost of care homes in line to be closed." His sentiment was backed by independent candidate Spud Murphy and Respect Party member Paulette North. Mr Murphy said, "I definitely would not be closing these services if I get in. I would keep them open, especially the daycare centres." Now, we've got a bit of a spread of opinion there, but ultimately, surely Mr Ferguson's right. We just can't afford to carry on with these care homes. Robin?
Well, if George Ferguson means that the current system is unsustainable and we need to get rid of capitalism, then I agree with him. But I'm not sure that's what he's saying. I think he's saying that under the budgetary restrictions that the council faces, then it isn't possible to sustain properly funded public services. And that's where I would take issue with him, because this comes back to the very reason that the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance was set up. We do not accept the premise that these cuts are necessary. We do not accept the premise that there is no money in this country, or that the deficit is so large that it has to be sorted out tomorrow morning, or otherwise the country will go bankrupt. As many commentators have said, there have been much greater deficits and debts in this country, especially after 1945. We have to say with the care homes that we will fight to retain them. And Marvin Rees, I'm afraid, once again, New Labour, very mealy mouth. He wants less care homes closed. Okay. No care home should be closed.
OK, Robin, we're coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, who didn't manage to make it. We have an empty chair, I'm afraid, for Liberal Democrat councillor Chris Davis. After the news, blink of you'll have missed it, but the plans were announced this week to merge Bristol's two enormous NHS foundations.
.org.uk, BCFM News, from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, 9 years after her disappearance, the parents of Shafili